Hi, and welcome to Motherfucklore. If you're a regular listener to the show, you know we often talk about themes and topics that hang on the thread of Irish ideas of inclusion and exclusion, belonging, community. These are topics that are dealt with in the writing of today's guest. Her name is Fadila Salahu. She's a writer and a student who is based in Dublin. Today in our chat, we discuss ideas like being Muslim in Ireland, Irish cuisine and who gets left out from things like ham sandwiches and Irish breakfasts, the common threads between colonial subjects choosing to document their struggle in the English language as opposed to the language that maybe is traditional to them, the language as part of a revival movement they want to be part of. And that's coming up right after this message. Today's episode of Motherfucklore is brought to you by the show's supporters on Patreon. Supporters such as Sarah Hart and Jared O'Sullivan. Gurmila Mahagov, Sarah August Jared. Supporters of the show get access to bonus features such as our live video chats with recent guests. We just this very week we had Niamh Lear on. The previous week we had Orla Nigul on, who both have been on extremely popular recent episodes. And Patreon supporters are able to ask them questions, tune in live, as well as, and if they couldn't make it live, they get access to the whole video content the next day released there. Here's a little clip of one we did this week with Niamh Lear. You know, you only hear about big news, and it's the little news that really kind of keeps people together. The internet has maybe changed that. Certainly social media has changed that.
Or even like RIP.ie. Mm-hmm. A revelation. My mum checks it every single morning. And she feels every single morning, and she feels so much more connected to home and what's going on. And like if someone's died, she'll call her brother who lives in Athlone and be like, Jimmy, there's a funeral up in May you've got to go to. And like, I think for her, she's the oldest daughter.
Yeah.
And I think in some ways it's her fulfilling the role that she felt she always had to have. And she can maintain that position in her family remotely, which I think is really important for a lot of people.
So do check it out at patreon.com/Darek. And now, the show. From the Hestive Podcast Network, welcome to Motherfucklore, a podcast about words, Irish, Irish words, and words from Ireland. I'm Derek O'Shea. I'm very lucky to be joined today by a special guest who is a student and a writer based here in Dublin City. Her name is Fadila Salahu. Fáilte go Motherfuckler, Fadila.
Thank you, Grimalgut.
Oh, Fáilte wrote. Fadila, why don't you tell our listeners a bit about yourself?
Well, I am a university student. I come from a Nigerian-Irish background, so my parents are Nigerian, and I was born and raised in Dublin. So I suppose I've had to navigate an extra element of my identity while, you know, just growing up and dealing with being young at the same time. So that's kind of fuel for my writing, and then I just, you know, study law on the side.
On the side, on top of everything else. When did you realize you wanted to be a writer?
Probably in third year, when I was studying for my junior cert, and I got an English Grimes tutor. And basically in the process of him, you know, helping me get a better grade, he told me that I might have a talent for writing, that I should consider pursuing it, that I could potentially, you know, write some really good stuff. And I didn't believe him because I pushed it aside. I thought writing and storytelling was, I had only really related it to my primary school experience. You know, everyone does creative writing and we have to write stories. And the only thing I ever credited myself for was not ending every story with, and they all woke up and it was all a dream. So I suppose that was all I really gave myself credit for. So I never really considered any talent with writing. And I didn't really like to look at what I read either. I think that was like a confidence thing as well. But yeah, that's when I actually really started to consider it.
I think a lot of talents, the growth of talent and the growth of standards I'd like to think they go hand by hand in hand. And you decided, yes, this wasn't good enough to end a story this way. So that's fantastic. So, and then you mentioned there were those are grinds in English, and your English tutor encouraged your writing this way. How did you feel about Irish when you were in school?
I really, really liked Irish, from the jump, like from the get-go, I just really enjoyed it. I was learning it just alongside everyone else at school. It was pleasant. I really enjoyed it to the point where I would get a bit like I get a bit defensive when people would complain about the subject, because obviously people didn't think it was taught in the most engaging way. And people would say stuff like, oh, what's the point? It's a dead language. We're never going to speak it. We're never going to use it, you know? And I would be like, guys, you know, it's great. And I had a passion for all things languages. I was very protective over it and defensive. And I was like, guys, it has so much richness and history and culture. And I'd get defensive and people would be like, why do you care? Like, after your exams, you're not going to speak it like the rest of us. And I suppose I was only, I didn't voice all of my passion for the Irish language, because I always felt a bit conscious of doing so, because I was wondering, like, is it really my place to defend this language? My Irish Nigerian self telling, you know, fully Irish people that they should care more about this language, like, maybe it's not my place. Shouldn't it be the other way around? That kind of thing.
Well, I'd like to think it's entirely your place, and the Irish language is welcome to anyone who wants in. I certainly hope so. And what did you feel when you were doing Leaving Cert more fairly recently compared to the rest of the Mother Folklore team? So your memories are a bit fresher and maybe more urgently relevant to some of our listeners who haven't done their Leaving Cert yet. How did you feel about the texts you were studying and the legendary Sroffic tour?
Oh, the Sroffic tour were my favorite. I loved the practical aspect of it, like just speaking the language in a way that wasn't very formal, because you're telling a story. And I feel like that kind of marks whether or not you really do or don't grasp a language, like if you can express yourself in that way. And I don't think I realized at the time, but it was a combination of storytelling and language use that are two of my favorite things now. So it probably makes sense, like, subconsciously, why I was so drawn to it and why I enjoyed it so much. I like showing off of it. I liked showing off, like, oh, look at all this vocabulary I have. I just really love this language. But in terms of the texts, we studied Gaffa by Ray O'Lilish, and that was about a heroin addict. So I feel like anything people felt negatively towards the Irish language, it was kind of dispelled by how juicy the story was. So I feel like everyone really just had a good time studying it. It was really interesting and really well told. And it touched on a lot of issues in Irish society.
Definitely. I'm sure Ray would be delighted to hear that if he ever does listen. I'm not sure. But that's fantastic. And tell me, what languages did you have in the home when you were growing up?
I had English and Yoruba, but Yoruba is a bit secondary for reasons that are a bit tetchy, I suppose. It kind of irritates me to think about. It's not really irritates. I think it's more like regret. Like, it was something I wish I had. So the story is basically that my parents, being Nigerian, grew up in Nigeria, and they moved here, and they grew up with Yoruba as their first language. And they learned English formally, like, at school. And they have all this, you know, they're able to speak English, basically. So they got here and they had my older brother. And they decided that, you know, they would raise him speaking Yoruba, because he would have all of the opportunities in the world to speak English for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
But he probably wouldn't have any other opportunities to speak Yoruba and to get comfortable and to get in touch with his culture and heritage and, you know, all that stuff.
Yes.
So basically they decided to, you know, start doing this, and, you know, he started school. And the teachers, I don't know what was the telltale sign, because I doubt he was speaking Yoruba in the classroom, but they confronted my parents, and they were like, this is not a good idea. You know, your son's going to grow up confused. You know, his English is going to suffer. He's not going to be able to communicate properly. Like, they were all of these excuses. I suppose I call them excuses because I don't really believe they affected it, because we have seen how many people successfully navigate two languages, you know?
Yes.
So they gave all these reasons, and my parents basically gave up on speaking Yoruba at home for what they thought was, you know, the benefit of their child. You know, they wanted him to, you know, have equal chances and all that stuff. So basically, Yoruba stayed alive in my household. They spoke it between themselves, but they mainly spoke to us kids in English. So we do have, like, we are able to, you know, we're familiar enough with the language, but we definitely, you can tell that we lack that aspect of really engaging with it from a young age and speaking it and expressing ourselves in it, you know, which I think is most important. And it kind of shows like a slight disconnect between the identities.
That's for sure. And like, I can see that, that there's probably a lot of Irish people with similar stories about their relationship with Irish, and particularly parents from Gaelic areas when they moved to Dublin or the other large towns, who didn't maybe feel before there was the surge in confidence in the Irish language, maybe this back in the 50s and 60s, they didn't like encourage their children, or didn't speak Irish around their children, or encourage that to be done. So, and in some cases, so it's a very interesting story. And like Nigeria would have had as a language kind of debate similar to Ireland, and that there's obviously Nigeria has several languages, and there's an ongoing kind of controversy as to whether English should be given prominence. I know Chinua Achebe was criticized for choosing to write in English, yeah. And well, criticized, or rather that there was back whatever 60 years ago when he wrote Things Fall Apart, there was it wasn't necessarily seen as the done thing.
Yeah. I love that you mentioned him, because on my trip to Nigeria last summer, I fell in love with literature, particularly African literature, as a way of telling the continent's history. And when I came across the criticism of Achebe's work, and I read a lot of his works myself now, I think that's really interesting, because as much as, like, I realize that when I speak, some people might think that I have, like, a resentment for the English language, and I just hate it as a symbol of, like, colonialism and all the horrible things of the past and cultural oppression. But at the end of the day, it is a very dominant language, and it is very convenient and, I think, productive to write in the language, because now we can see that his work has reached so many more people than it would have had he written it in his language of Igbo. And I think that that's even more important. You know, the Igbo people will still have their language struggles and their fights to keep their language alive and their culture and their history. But at the same time, him writing in English helps non-Igbo people to understand this struggle and understand this history and, you know, kind of realize the effects of English presence and English language and all of the things that go with that.
And even the fact that he does kind of use some of the Igbo loan words in that particular text. I haven't read much of his other works except for his essays, which are very powerful. His essay on Conrad is essential reading, and particularly on how Africa is represented by European writers was really thought-provoking in a way that hadn't occurred to me before I was in university, when I guess we had been so familiar with adventure tales set in Africa or in India, like King Solomon's Mines and like The Heart of Darkness, which took took an unnecessarily Eurocentric perspective on something that was happening. It was a tragedy happening to another country.
Yeah. I like particularly like your mention of his use of loan words, because I like in texts that are, you know, set in another country but written in English, where they would use like words, but they wouldn't like have footnotes like this word means this, or let me translate this for you, because I'm like, yeah, you don't need to explain it. You know, people who read this can go and try and figure it out for themselves, the same way that, you know, people who speak this language have had to do all the work themselves in English. Like, I like the aspect of not necessarily owing anyone an explanation for your own language.
Absolutely. And of course, Things Fall Apart's been translated to Irish.
Has it?
Yeah, Ola Majakadoni and I did an episode about it last year, just talking about how this classic Nigerian novel was translated into Irish. They kept the Igbo loan words, obviously, because they didn't translate them into English. They should be also left intact. And some of the folk tales, when they're actually that are recounted by characters in the books, they like the one about the tortoise and how the world was created and things, they actually sound a lot like kind of Irish traditional stories, and they're translated that way. It's a very well executed translation. The translator was the wife of the former Irish ambassador to Nigeria.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I feel like like in reading that work, it will become so like obvious to every reader, like how similar, yet different, of course, but how similar the stories of the Igbo people and the Irish people are, or the stories of like most Nigerians, you know, and Ireland, both of them being former British colonies. And, you know, all of the fallout from all of the history is always going to be, there's always going to be parallels between that. And that's something that I realized myself, which is, I think, the first time I ever really interacted with you, I suppose, was when I tweeted about Crack Baby, your book. And I just noticed, like, it was so profound when I read it, that so much of what you wrote about, you know, and Irish culture and Irish language and how it's really, how it stays alive and how it's being preserved. And it was what I felt related a lot to my private struggle between, you know, Yoruba and my household, and what is the proper language to speak and what is the official and professional language and all of that kind of stuff, you know?
Well, thank you very much. I remember, because you had mentioned it, I wrote a particular chapter in Crack Baby, my second book, which was about different perceptions of multilingual children, and specifically how a lot of Europeans, they aspire to, they look, Irish and English people look to Switzerland and Belgium and wonder how these kids can manage to have three or four languages, but two or three blocks in their house, there might be immigrant families with three or four languages, and it's treated like a problem to be solved.
Yeah, definitely. You can see that in just, like, you know, regular people attitudes. Like, I don't want to say the average person, but I suppose, like, the public perception of, I grew up with Romanian friends, Polish friends, friends like myself who, you know, had backgrounds in African languages. And it was so commendable. Like, if we had a foreign student who, I don't know, spoke French or Spanish and then was also speaking English, it's like, wow, this is just so amazing. And we're like, but we're kind of doing the same thing. But no, this particular way, kind of just like the hypocrisy. And people don't even realize that it's a bit of a double standard. But
It's funny when, all right, when you when people do that. Someone said that when you're in a, sometimes if you're in a job interview and it's acceptable for one person to say, oh, I'm trying to remember what this is actually called in English, you know, en français, we call it this. And a person can appear very, very intellectual if they've experienced some ideas in French or Italian first, but it's seen as less so in certain things. It does tie into this idea that, like, how we perceive multilingualism as a talent or as a state of transition.
Yeah, definitely. Even how we view accents as well. You know, certain accents are easily just far more acceptable than others, you know, and far more,
yes.
You know, it'd be like, oh, wow, maybe a French or German accent, or when they mispronounce a word, it'd be like, oh, wow, such a cute mistake or a nice little accent. Whereas maybe someone from, I don't know, a cute mistake, do people say that? But maybe someone from India would do the same thing, and it would be viewed as, you know, this person didn't try hard enough. This person isn't educated. And I hate the correlation or the mental association we have between people's ability to speak English and their level of intelligence. It's just absurd. Like, it doesn't make any sense. English is a language, not a measure of intelligence. Like, it never has been. And it's like, just at its core, it's just such a flawed concept.
We talked there about Nigeria shares with Ireland a colonial history, particularly British colonial history. But one of the, I guess, other kinds of colonialism, and maybe one that maybe Ireland is more at the forefront of, is, I guess, missionary work. And for a lot of Irish people, this is an experience that Ireland had a very high output of Christian missionaries, particularly in the 20th century and beforehand, especially in Africa. And it was a way of imposing European values that ran parallel with the colonial process. And this is something often that people, Irish people are aware of, but for someone who comes from a non-Christian tradition in Africa, is that a different experience? Do you find that maybe as an Irish person of Nigerian heritage, but not of Christian heritage, do you have a different experience of growing up in 21st century Ireland than an Irish person of Nigerian heritage who is Catholic?
Probably.
Or is that a big question?
No. I think I do. Mm-hmm. Naturally, of course, because when you have two different backgrounds, like, I tried to make as many connections. I don't know if I actively tried to make these connections, but I ended up coming to the conclusions that, oh, in language, we're so similar in this way. And in our history, we're so similar in this way. Whereas I wasn't quite able to make that link between religion, because personally, I just couldn't relate. When my first primary school was an educate together. So it was just multi-denominational and just full of, you know, all sorts of kids from all sorts of different backgrounds, just running around and sharing all these experiences. It kind of felt like being at an international school because there was just so much cultural influence from everywhere.
Yeah.
And then in fourth class, I moved to a Catholic national school. And that was a shock for me. That was really something. Because I had read about, you know, saying prayers at school, and I had read about all of these things that are, you know, typically traditional Irish national school experiences. And I was like, wow, that must be something, you know, it must be so interesting to have this, you know, traditional schooling system. And then I was in it. And I found that super interesting. And it was a bit, at times it felt a bit lonely, just kind of like sitting in the classroom, everyone's, you know, head down or saying their prayers and stuff, you know, in one voice as well. And just the symbolism of there being one voice and your voice not being part of it. It's, you know, as a kid, it's a bit sad, I suppose.
But yeah,
at the same absolutely. Time, I was pretty confident in my Muslimness. And I had friends in that, you know, in my first primary school, the multi-denominational one, and they were Nigerian Christian, and they were able to relate on a lot more levels, even down to the food they ate, because, you know, a ham sandwich, such a quintessentially Irish thing, it's something that I've never eaten in my life, you know? So, it can all come down to a ham sandwich, basically.
I remember thinking that so much of Irish, so much of Irish traditional cuisine, when you take away the ham sandwich, the full Irish breakfast, and then kind of, and I suppose the shellfish as well, we probably don't even realize how exclusionary some of our national cuisine is to people who aren't Catholic Christian.
I think even vegetarians have a hard time.
Oh yes,
like, you know, so much of, you know, even a Sunday dinner is just pretty inaccessible to them, you know.
There's only so many times you can have mushroom risotto in a week. It's funny because often the only vegetarian option in many restaurants will be this mushroom risotto, and it's it does seem to be kind of thrown together. But that's you mentioned that you moved to a kind of a Catholic national school in fourth class. So then there probably was situations there where there was preparation for confirmation and other religious events during class time.
Yeah, that was also something different. And there were a couple of incidents where, like, you know, it was sixth class and, you know, my whole class was off at church, you know, practicing and preparing and rehearsing. And because my whole class was gone, I had to, you know, you had to be moved into another class. But it was just the fact that I was, you know, a dignified sixth class student sitting with third classers. I was like, oh my gosh, the injustice of it all. You know, but yeah, sometimes
the symbolism of that being sent back to a smaller class, it's one thing, like when the symbolism of being sent back to a smaller class does seem quite pointed.
Yeah, you know, but like, it wasn't, of course it wasn't their fault, and there were other students who, you know, were also not taking part. But yeah, it just felt, it felt a bit exclusionary, but it was what it was, I suppose. And also, like, during class time as well, it was insane to me how much time in the actual classroom was spent on, like, specifically religious activities. And when I say specifically religious, I mean specifically Catholic activities, which was just, like, myself and two other Irish kids who weren't, like, who were atheist, I think, or whose parents didn't want them to participate, and a Chinese friend of mine. We were just like, we really spend a hell of a lot of time on this. And it's just, I recognize, and as a practicing Muslim myself, I would love for my kids to go, like, if my future Muslim children that I don't have, I need to specify, I would love for them to, you know, feel that their school system really, really caters to them and really respects their religious tradition and upholds it and fosters it. But at the same time, being a Muslim kid in a Catholic setting where exactly that was being done, it did feel a bit, you know, it was a bit awkward to navigate. And I think it was also pointed because these children were not necessarily from practicing Catholic families, you know? I feel like that's the difference.
Yeah.
Because for them, for most people that I know, most of my friends who went through their communion and their confirmation, that was pretty much their last encounter with the religion to this point, like to our age as we are now. So
yeah,
I found it, it's a bit strange, like as important and as special as it is for so many people, which I respect and I think is really beautiful. It also felt a bit redundant that sometimes. It felt a bit yeah. like just for the sake of tradition, you know?
It does seem, and I can completely see why that would make you feel. And it's for a lot of people from kind of from Catholic traditions who maybe aren't very, very involved in the church, they might find that sometimes it's just easier to just go with the flow, and it can feel like a nuisance to kind of completely extricate yourself from it. If you think, well, if somebody thinks that they want to get married in a church, or they want to, and I know particularly arranging a kind of arranging a non-religious funeral seems to be a complete, like an administrative nightmare at a time when you just don't want to be dealing with any additional stress. And I can see that for schools as well. People just think that's just easier just to muck in, to go along with it. And yeah. it is a real shame, because it does, I think when you stop and think about it, you realize it can be quite coercive just to have these things, particularly communion and confirmation, when little girls are getting dressed up in these little white dresses and getting gifts of money. It's very hard to explain that to children who don't get to participate in that.
Yeah, it is. I mean, of course, I feel like for a lot of people, they were taking part in it because their parents didn't want to deprive them of a tradition. Like you said, they might just feel it's more convenient, more easy to just go along with it. Because I know people who were taking part in their communions and their confirmations, and at the same time, they were saying, my parents are absolutely against everything to do with the Catholic Church, but there they were, you know, performing all of the rites of passage. And, you know, and of course, who wants to explain to their child, like, why they're not getting a ridiculous amount of money when everyone else their age is, you know?
I was at a funeral last year, and I was just talking to some of my friends, nieces and nephews who were there, who were small, and they were telling me how much money they were clocking up in their communions and confirmations, and I was just astonished. They were making more money than a freelance journalist, that's for sure. So in Islam, the interpretation of Quran texts and other sacred texts, the significance of translation, it's unlike, say, a big problem in Christianity is that people interpret bad translations of the Bible, take the bits they like very literally and run with it, whereas Islam does warn against bad translating the Quran, and that it should be read where possible in its original, in original Arabic. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, I think now that I think about it, the fact that, you know, I come from a religious background where language is so central, because it is, you know, the lingua franca of the whole religion, Arabic, is that. And just the fact that most Muslims make the conscious effort to become familiar with that Arabic language in order to, you know, understand their religious texts. And a while ago, I used to think that it was a bit uncomfortable with it, because it was the same kind of, I thought it was pretty imposing. I thought that it could lead to this kind of thing of Arab supremacy, because of course there are native Arabic speakers and surely they would feel like they have an advantage, or they would feel like, you know, they're better off. But I came to realize how important it is that there is just like the one, you know, single text that remains the same no matter how you want to read it. Like, you know, there can only be really one version of it. So the fact that everyone goes out of their way to learn Arabic means that they're actively taking part in preserving, you know, this one religious text. Because I started to think, like, what if we had, you know, written the Quran in a bunch of different languages? Of course you can find translations, but, you know, changed, because everyone prays in Arabic as well, you know, the ritual prayer. But I mean, in terms of like a private prayer, like, oh God, I really want this, everyone does it in their own language. So just to clarify that. But everyone prays in Arabic, everyone reads the Quran in Arabic. And I was like, well, if everyone did pray differently, there would be no unity. there would be, it would feel a bit like there would be a disjointedness, because one of the things that I really like most about the religion is that no matter where you are a Muslim in the world, you can always meet another Muslim and you will still have the same greeting of peace, salamu alaikum, which is in Arabic, you know, standard. Mm-hmm. And you will be able to pray side by side and you will pray the exact same way. And, you know, all of the, you have so much shared tradition. And the fact that I had to learn this language in order to practice my faith, you know, the best that I can, I think it really showed me the importance of language in itself, because all of the expressions in the Quran, all of the metaphors, all of the stories being told, like, it really is such a unique experience. And, you know, if you've ever listened to the Quran, you know, it's really melodic and really rhythmic. And there's, and if you study it again, it's even deeper and richer. So I think it's just amazing. And I think subconsciously, that was probably the first encounter I had with language. Yeah. And its importance and studying it. Because when I was like 7 years old, going to a Muslim Sunday school, if you will, and learning this, I didn't really understand it. But now I realize just how powerful it is and the symbolism of learning a language.
Absolutely. And so you would have been learning little bits of Arabic in Sunday school. So
yeah, alongside, you know, all of the moral lessons and all of that kind of stuff.
Of course, it's, and so along with English and Irish and that, and having the small bits of Europe at home, it's a fairly rich linguistic kind of a backdrop to have growing up.
Yeah, it was quite unique. Yeah.
This came up recently. I think the Arabic and Irish share the same word for a knife. I think it's skian.
Yeah, I saw that, and it was quite fascinating. I mentioned it to my friend, and she is in love with all things folklore. And also in love with Irish. And she was the one who helped me Gaelify my name. I don't know. I tweeted about it. Fadila Nick Gilladay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she was the one who helped me do that. And I sent her a screenshot of that, you know, Arabic-Irish parallel. And she was like, she mentioned the thing about the Black Irish. Because I remember reading about Irish ethnicity and how diverse it is. And,
yes,
you know, how different Irish people can look from each other, yet, you know, everyone is still Irish. And she mentioned the Black Irish, which is a term I've never heard of before. And you're like, I was like, are you talking about me? She's like, no. she was referring to people who are ethnically Irish, who have roots in Ireland, you know, indisputably Irish, who are just inexplicably darker than, you know, what you'd expect an Irish person to look like. And I've met so many people who just, you could easily mistake them for Mediterranean, and they're just fully yeah. Irish. It was really interesting.
It's a funny one, because it used to be like people used to say, oh, then when the Spanish Armada kind of crashed off the coast of Galway, a few of the Spanish sailors intermingled with the local community. But no, it's and what if that happened? It didn't happen on the scale which would explain the amount of very dark haired people in the west of Ireland with kind of with dark brown eyes and the kind of those kind of East Mediterranean features. I know that archaeologists and other researchers have traced that back to migration patterns going back 3,000 years. That can be, that suggests that yes, it may have been somewhere from the East Mediterranean area. It is a fascinating thing. All right, and it's a wonder. It'd be a wonder if any loan word survived from that long ago without being replaced by all the languages that came since.
Yeah, it's really amazing.
We love to ask all our guests what their favorite Irish word is, but if you have favorite words in any of the other languages that have come your way as well, we'd love to hear those too.
Oh my, it's been a while since I've had to think about this. Regrettably, I haven't spoken much Irish since going into university. The favorite Irish word. Favorites are hard, you know, generally for me. Words that I just like the sound of, maybe. Like, I like the sound of the word banya, but it doesn't mean anything. Like, it's just milk.
Yeah, banya is a great word.
I think I like the word chokrasa.
But chokrasa. Yeah,
I like the poem Gavin, which I had to study for the Leaving Cert. You know,
oh, yes.
It starts with Anbi May, Anbi Alta Asna Chokrasa. I was a wild animal from the Chokrasa, which is like the warm savanna-ish areas. And nice. I like the way it sounds. And yeah, I like the fact that it has Cho in there, which also kind of alludes to its warmness. I think that's cool.
That is great.
I suppose that's my word.
That's a gorgeous word. And before we wrap up, where can people find you and find your writing?
I write at medium.com/Fadila. You will probably find better stuff up there in times to come. I think I'm just kind of warming up and dusting off my writing cobwebs.
Good stuff. Can people find you on Twitter or not? Or would you rather keep that private?
I don't tweet anything of significance, but you can follow me at Fadila_Salau. You might be disappointed, though.
No, I'm sure not. Fadila, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, until the next time, slán go fóill. Well, that's almost it for us for another week. Thank you so much to Fadila for being a brilliant guest. Before we wrap up, I just want to say a bit of housekeeping. I want to thank Brian very much for being an excellent and patient producer. I want to thank Kirsten Scheel for being an amazing artist who's done the art for this episode and all our episodes. You should check out her work in the link in our show notes. If you want to contact the show, you can do so at motherfucklore@headstuff.org. You might also wish to consider supporting the continued production of Motherfucklore on Patreon. Those who support the show on Patreon get access to a range of other features. Bonus episodes. We've done two live video episodes this week and last week, which are available to anyone who chooses to subscribe now. We brought back Niamh Lear and Aura Nigul for episodes to discuss their popular episodes of Motherfucklore. Patreon supporters were able to ask them questions and participate a little bit. It was a great chat. There's also bonus discount codes, and there is a members forum and Discord and lots of other, and we're still adding new features there, so it's going to be getting better and better. Until next time, slán from me.
This has been a production of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
Don't let anyone hurt you if you don't think they'd be at your funeral. I was like, well, of course they're gonna be my
everyone's there.